Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We are chatting again with Dave Lotan, activist investor in small cap natural resource companies. Dave's been on the show a few times with us before, just simply sharing his outlook for these markets, what he likes, where he is attracted in small cap natural resource companies. Look, there's no denying that pretty much every sector right now is under pressure. Dave, I know you were at a conference last week. I was at a resource conference last week, and understandably so, the mood is, I don't want to say fully in the dumps, but people are worried because, quite frankly, stocks have been moving down, and some of the small cap stocks, boy, oh boy, they're moving back to trading for cash in the bank valuations. One topic that came up a fair bit at the conference I was at was the lack of M&A that we have seen in this sector. Even the last couple of years when metals were running and the stocks were running, we didn't seem to get a whole lot of M&A activity. We had a couple of the large guys join forces. We've had some takeouts, such as Great Bear last year, but that brought up a couple of comments of, is that the top of the market? Did some of those transactions last year, like Great Bear, that were for over $1 billion, did they signify a top in the market? I know it's hard to say, but Dave, what's your takeaway from some of those comments?
Well, first of all, Corey, no, I don't think those were top of the market transactions, probably adjusted for inflation. They're more comparable to, for instance, the $500 to $800 million transactions that occurred in the middle 2000s. So, for instance, when Agnico took over Meadowbank or took over Cumberland Resources for Meadowbank, that was about an $800 million transaction. And they later took over Comaplex for Meliadine, which was another $800 million transaction. And those were great deals. They were sort of in the 2005-2007 corridor. The real top of the market transactions occurred around 2010, and they were all sort of $7 to $8 billion transactions. And of course, I'm talking about Kinross's infamous acquisition of Redback, Barrick taking over Equinox all for cash, and Newcrest taking over Lihir Gold Mines for $7 billion. And I guess you could throw in Goldcorp taking over Andean for something like $5 billion around that time as well. So the transactions we're seeing today are really at a fraction of those values. And I don't think that you've seen the frequency yet that you will see. But when the large producers start to get pressured by mid-market companies snatching up assets, that the large producers are just taking their time on.
Well, Dave, you know, we did see, as Corey mentioned, some of the big boys kind of do mergers of equals, like the Barrick-Randgold, the Newmont Goldcorp, the SSR, Alacer. You know, we did see some of those kind of transactions, but we haven't really seen a ton of cash transactions. There have been a few, and the Great Bear was a kind of a mixed bag where there was some cash and some shares. But at the top of the market in 2010 and 2011, I remembered a lot of excessive cash takeovers, and it seemed like the theme then was add ounces at all costs, like just add ounces onto the books. And then many times it didn't matter if they weren't profitable. And obviously we know how the rest of that story worked out. They weren't profitable, and a lot of them had to be written off. So do you think that we'll see something like that again once things get frothier in the space, or is it just a different era altogether?
Well, I think there'll need to be a philosophical paradigm change at the producing companies. Kinross, for instance, had to take over Great Bear using cash in their own view because they were trading below their NAV. And NAV is a notoriously tricky number to come up with. You have a bunch of analysts who do some NPV calculations on your assets and use whatever discount rate they think is appropriate. And then you get sort of a consensus NAV for your company. And in chatting with the friends of mine at Kinross late last year, they were frustrated feeling the need to reposition their portfolio into more acceptable jurisdictions, but of course, struggling with the fact that they were trading below consensus NAV. So you start to see cash acquisitions when companies are making very comfortable amounts of free cash flow and they are trading below NAV. It's a very common thing with the Australian companies, St. Barbara, for instance, taking over Atlantic Gold all for cash. I found that baffling personally. I think that NAVs are extremely suspect in their accuracy, but you need both ingredients to be in place: high degrees of free cash flow, lots of access to debt capital, and companies trading at or below their NAVs to see those cash takeovers. I'm not always impressed with Fortuna's acquisitions, but they tend to give paper away, which I think is the responsible way to do it. That's what they did for Rox Gold, and that's what they did for Gold Rock in Argentina. So I think you'll see those, but selectively over time. And of course, the deeper we go into this cycle, the more these companies cannibalize their current reserves. And when Kirkland Lake and Agnico merge, they don't create any growth. That's a synergies-driven, cost-driven event, and it just gives them a much larger production profile to have to replace over the coming cycles. So those aren't great for juniors. They occupy a lot of time and a lot of human capital at those large companies, but they sow the seeds for crazy acquisition markets in the future.
So Dave, to your point about companies needing to be flush with cash, what did you think of that Newmont share repurchase program where they bought back $1 billion worth of shares because they are sitting on so much cash? However, the market turned on them and then they gave up over $1 billion in market cap shortly after.
Yeah, that's baffling to me that Newmont would be buying back shares when they have all the same problems that other extractive companies have with some portion of their assets getting mined and converted to cash on a daily basis. And of course, they have the best value of any mining companies because they're in the S&P 500 and they benefit from this tidal wave of passive money that gets allocated on a monthly basis from 401ks. And Mike Green is ubiquitous on podcasts talking about that. And if anyone wants to research that, I would encourage them to search Mike. So Newmont doing share buybacks is nonsensical in my view. As we discussed before we came on today, they also bought Buenaventura out of Yanacocha, and then they bought the Japanese partners out as well. And I think that they're constantly optimizing their portfolio. So they're doing both. They are out there looking for good deals to lengthen the duration of their asset portfolio. And the buybacks, I think, are just something that are fashionable at the moment. And it's financial engineering. Debt is cheap. So companies borrow money at close to zero and buy their shares back. And they are convinced by the investment banking community that this is a good use of capital and that it's optimization of leverage on their balance sheet. And I don't personally buy it, but for Newmont, I think it's a wash.
Well, Dave, we see in the space a lot of people hoping that their precious junior, whichever one they hold, is the next takeover candidate. Everybody thinks they're next. And the reality is, Corey and I talk to companies all the time, and there's a ton of companies on the market right now that have 1 million, 2 million, 4 million, 8 million ounces of gold in the ground. And there are dozens of them and the development stage, what we'd call the developers. Ideally, those would be the bolt-on projects that producers would grab and have the teams and experience to bring in production. But it seems like we're awash in companies with millions of ounces. Why are there not more of those getting nabbed at this point? And are they even going to get grabbed during this cycle?
Yeah, that is always the question. And I think that people ask that question about Genesis for many years. And then Mike Gentile, who had already gotten activist on Superior, saw an opportunity to combine those companies together, hoping that you're in a 1+1=3 situation. And I think the same could be said of East Main for a lot of years. They had some interesting ounces in the James Bay lowlands in Quebec, close to Éléonore. And it really took Ivan Bebek having to do some backfilling on the Orne valuation to take that out and then, you know, split his company up and create these three companies. And I think that was a really interesting tactical move on Ivan's part and very smart. One of the reasons that these resources sit out there at very, very low valuations is often that they don't work. There are many million ounce deposits or multi-million ounce deposits in Quebec that are simply too low grade to be mined underground, which is the way in which they would have to be mined given their geometry. So when you see people who have 1-1.5 gram cutoffs on mines that clearly need to be underground, well, that's just never going to work. So it's important for investors to just look at the resource as a starting point, as an appetizer. And then when you dig down into it, what you find is many of these things can never be mines unless, of course, you have some fantastic new technology or have invented something that temporarily suspends the laws of physics and gravity. So resources are the most dangerous thing to buy. As an investor, I don't often feel equipped to know what the fatal flaws are. Sometimes it's very obvious. It's a million ounces that has to be mined underground and therefore grade's too low. Or it's going to be an open pit in an area where you can't actually have an open pit because of community issues or water problems or some other issue that isn't often obvious to passive investors.
So, Dave, what about jurisdictional risk then? Because it seems like even tier one jurisdictions aren't garnering much value for ounces in the ground. Where do you think are good jurisdictions? Where are you avoiding?
Yeah, I've never been keen on anything in the United States, to be frank. It's the most developed economy in the world. It's the most developed culture in the world. And I don't know why anyone would buy into the idea of having giant cavities carved into the earth that you can see from space, even if it isn't within sight of their property. I was talking with Bill Powers the other day on his podcast of their trilogy and these fantastic deposits they have in Alaska. And, you know, they had fantastic support from NANA and ADIA and had a road permit revoked by the federal government under circumstances that I had never seen before. And it's just crazy. There's all kinds of pro-energy transition policies going on in the States. And here you have these fantastic copper and cobalt mines, which have been set back years now as a result of government policies, which are frankly full of contradictions. So I don't like the United States. I mean, I love it as a country. I just don't want to invest in projects there. Maybe in Arizona, maybe in Nevada. All the other states are suspect from my standpoint. And I completely understand people living there not wanting mining to go on. And in Canada, it's really all about First Nations. If you're making an investment anywhere in Canada, you better understand which First Nations groups are close by. If there are multiple First Nations groups, there better be a tribal council so there's unified decision-making. Otherwise, you could be mired in problems for years. And First Nations often make decisions that don't appear to be commercially rational because they are small minorities, they're subsidized, they're more concerned with maintaining their existing quality of life, often subsistence hunting, that sort of thing. So, and I guess when it comes to the rest of the world, clearly I'm deeply involved in Finland. I still think Mexico in certain places is a great place to invest. And again, it sort of goes state by state, province by province in a lot of these South American countries as well. You know, Santa Cruz is famously the right place to be in Argentina. Is that true? Seems to be. But it's a long, long topic of conversation, really.
Yeah, it is, Dave. And even areas that are considered bad jurisdictions sometimes get mines developed and built where areas that are considered great, you know, top shelf tier one jurisdictions have stalls and permitting issues for quite a long time. So you just never really know it. Sometimes it comes down to literally the local community around the mine. What about the problem that we're seeing in the industry due to inflationary pressures of just the big cost overruns to get projects built, whether you're a producer that's trying to develop one of your projects, like we've seen a couple doozies lately that tanked the share price, or just a development company that has an older economic study. And by old, I mean over a year old. They're out of date now, and they pretty much have to be torn up and reevaluated. How is that going to possibly crimp the new supply of mines coming online and M&A deals combined?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I think IAM Gold is the Walking Dead now, and Argonaut is not very far behind. And all of this is a hangover from Malartic in the last cycle, which was a mining camp with numerous high-grade mines, and Osisko came in and grid drilled it, and they were successful in reaching the gold porphyry underneath, if that's what you call it, and they turned it into a massive mine. It was probably something that would only work in Quebec, where you could move all those houses and where you had 2 or 3 cent megawatt power, but it was the sort of sensation that captures mining companies and pushes them in the direction of looking for those large scale projects. And Detour was the closest imitator falling in behind. And of course, that mine was completely inappropriate for a company with only a single asset, always challenged for working capital and a gigantic earth-moving exercise with lots and lots of fragility built into it by Mother Nature. So Côté Lake and Magino are even lower quality, or were even lower quality in my view, than Detour. And they were both bought for pretty pennies by those companies. And I think that the problem with trying to grab scale for your company is it isn't always there. And these particular large scale earth moving operations are far more susceptible to cost inflation and CapEx inflation than, for instance, small high grade projects. So the real champions that came out of the last cycle are companies like Wesdome, Richmont, which was bought by Alamos, and of course, New Market / Crocodile Gold acquisition by Kirkland Lake, where you had companies going after high-grade underground opportunities and where you had entirely new deposits discovered from drilling underground. And so I'm not a huge fan of the industry's fascination with scale. And I think especially when you have companies in the middle that are reaching up for scale, that have never proven that they can build small cities and mines in the midst of them, it's pretty high risk. And really, inflation is the devil that kills those projects, especially because the grades are so low.
Yeah, mining is tough, whether it's small or big. But the fact of the matter is you can run into a lot of issues, and inflation, that doesn't help anybody even move towards a construction decision, let alone if they're already building it, seeing their costs escalate. Mm-hmm. But David, what about different resources? Which resources do you like? What do you think is set up for maybe a longer term run here? Because when you look across the board, resources broadly have pulled back. A lot of different metals have pulled back from some of the recent highs, but historically, they're still at very high levels. So which resources do you seem to be gravitated to right now?
Well, I think the fossil fuel business, unfortunately, is the one that's going to benefit the most from the turmoil that we have going on in Europe. And I think that Europe is in for a very difficult decade. All of the things that I had to say about the United States and the very intuitive conclusion that you draw looking at an advanced economy like that, why would anyone want giant mines in the United States? It's very easy to understand why they would, unless you're dealing with states that are less populous and that need economic stimulation. Just multiply it by 10 in Europe, where there's been no capital put into sourcing raw materials locally for many decades, other than, I suppose, coal in a lot of these countries that had a lot of electricity generation from coal. So unfortunately, a flawed energy transition policy has left Europe relatively defenseless against Soviet aggression, and it's going to lead to high fossil fuel prices probably for the next 5 to 10 years. And it'll probably lead to higher coal prices because they'll have to put some of that back online. All of the nuclear that they took offline is very difficult to put back on, and they will put it back on, but it will take time. And I can't predict how that will affect uranium prices. And of course, fertilizer prices are also going to be a major issue with the Ukraine, which was the breadbasket of Europe, with those agricultural lands being taken out of service. So I think hydrocarbons, probably coal. I hate to say that. There's no way to make coal work with climate change agendas, although with fossil fuels, natural gas, I think it's a great transition fuel. Potash, phosphate, and there's probably a whole host of other commodities like neon, for instance, which was primarily sourced from Ukraine, which is necessary in silicon chips, and probably rhodium and iridium and a whole bunch of other stuff that I just haven't personally spent a lot of time on. But I remember iridium going to $10,000 a kilogram or something like that during the 2010s. And they eventually came up with a substitute or another process for that. But I would imagine there's money to be made in the more exotic commodities right now, but I'm not expert in those.
Well, Dave, just along that line, maybe just as we wrap up, a lot of investors, especially in the resource stocks, want to see that new blood. They want to see those new investors coming into the space. And mm-hmm. In past cycles, we typically saw gold do well, and then that brought in some interest in people diversifying into base metals. But one interesting environment that we found ourselves in a couple of years ago was this keyed in interest on energy metals or battery metals. That really became the flavor of the day. And we finally saw metals like copper or nickel get a little bid, not just because they're a base metal, but because they played into this battery narrative. We saw what happened to lithium. We've seen recently what's happened in uranium as a as an energy metal. Mm. And so there's other things like graphite and rare earths that kind of tie into that, some of those strategic metals you were just discussing. But it seemed like those were different investors coming in the space, some of them coming in through the side door of Tesla, or you know, getting excited about electric vehicles and saying, hey, I want to get into some of these batteries. Do you think that's an avenue to explore for the mining sector to draw in some new, younger, interested investors?
Yeah, riding along, surfing along on the wave created by the greatest stock promoter in human history, Elon Musk. It's really been a wonderful experience. I met a couple of guys at the Canaccord conference in Palm Springs who've become multi-decamillionaires on their lithium plays, and they were stocks I had never personally heard of. And I think we've got a lot of earth scientists in Canada who are skeptical of all things and will talk you out of lithium and talk about Lake Uyuni in Bolivia and all the massive solars in Chile. And of course, it does matter. There's a bottleneck in the lithium supply chain. Prices are high. They may not stay high long enough for some of these young fellows to mine their lithium brines in Argentina. But nonetheless, you've got $500 billion companies that have come out of nowhere with lithium. And it's all thanks to Tesla and the great work that Elon has done promoting the electrification of all things. Will that last? I think it will. And I think that you can see the climate lobby is extremely powerful, extremely well-funded. And one of the reactions to fossil fuel prices going up because of Ukraine is that we need to make this transition more rapidly to renewables and to electrification. So I don't personally think that that's the right way to transition. However, what I think doesn't matter. And I think that you'll probably be able to make money in nickel and cobalt and lithium for some time to come as a result of the powerful momentum behind this movement. And you know, I agree. It's better for us to move away from CO2 generating fuels. It's just the path that I question and its plausibility.
All right, Dave, we're going to wrap it up here. I always enjoy chatting with you, and I love the way that you look at these markets. Look, you've been around these markets for a while, and you've seen a lot of different stories play out, and I'm sure a lot of different stories not play out to the positive side, but that's just the market we are in, and right now it does feel tough when I know everyone's watching a lot of their stocks continue to drift lower and lower, and quite frankly, low volume as well. But again, these resources are still at generally high historic prices. It's just the market environment, unfortunately, that seems to be pulling everything down. Dave, thank you as always for your time, buddy. We'll have you back on the show much more regularly because, again, I love how you look at these markets. Thanks for your time, Dave. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks so much, fellas. It was great.